Welcome to Slight Reliability, learning SRE one day at a time. I'm Stephen Townsend. Hi there and welcome back to Slight Reliability. I'm Stephen Townsend and this is the show where we learn SRE one day at a time. Today I am joined by guests, Kyle Forster and Shay Stewart from Runwin. Before starting Runwin, Kyle was a senior director of product management on the Google Kubernetes team, where he was first introduced to SRE practices. And before Runwin, Shay spent the last several years building and running a high-end DevOps consultancy, which was famous for untangling some of Google's most complex cloud deployments. So hello, Kyle and Shay, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. We like to say it's Friday Junior over here. It's Thursday afternoon our time.
It's full on Friday in New Zealand because we're living in the future. I wanted to give you a chance just to tell us a little bit about Runwin. What is Runwin, and how did it come about?
Sure. So we're building a platform for SREs, very much inspired by the work that Shay did and that I did in our previous roles. We're building it for SREs to be able to work with other SREs, building out scripts for SLIs, SLOs, error budgets, automated tasks. And most of the folks that we're working with as we've entered into beta were generally their first ever engagement around building SLOs. For most of our clients, this is the first time they've ever built an SLO. For all of our clients, this is the first time that they've ever actually built an error budget. We're big believers in these practices. We've seen the kind of impact that a great SRE practice can have for an organization on a lot of different fronts, and we'd love to talk about that. And we're kind of building this product from what we've seen.
I think one of the interesting things about the way that Kyle and I come together, though, is from two very different views of the world. So, you know, Kyle's experience was working within Google, within a high-performing SRE, large SRE scale teams, which a lot of the customers I had worked with in my past, which were namely enterprises, didn't share some of the same challenges or didn't share some of the same engineering budgets to build that kind of change. And so they're a little bit latent in wanting to get onto the SRE bandwagon, where Google was, you know, at the forefront, obviously having written books about it and developed practices around it and really sort of defining the space. Whereas the customers I have now want to consume it in a way that posits that they don't have the same scale challenges, but they still have the same need for the function. So I think when we looked at Runwin, we kind of wanted to say, how do you get collaboration with engineers at Google-like scale without being Google? Mm. And I think that's kind of one of the interesting things about where Runwin started and wants to build in that space of cross-organizational collaboration.
And how would you describe the Runwin product in terms of what it does? What's the what's the summary of what it is?
The easiest way, when you first open it up, it feels kind of like Google Maps for your tech stack. It gives you something that looks almost like driving directions as you walk around your tech stack, and then visualizing all the buildings that you're driving past, which are your SLOs, your error budgets. And if you happen to stop at a building, what are the automated tasks that a senior member of the team has curated and put in that are really relevant for that particular building, kind of like a wonderful tourist list. Mm-hmm. So I think that this kind of metaphor of the map and this Google Maps like view into your tech stack, the processes underneath building that, I think, are really the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And the healthy part for an organization that's just building up an SRE practice or that has an SRE practice and is just getting into this particular form of management for it.
I will say that when I saw a bit of the product, to me, I'd never seen anything quite like it before. It was a bit like Google Street View, that's right, for your technology stack and being able to navigate around and go into the detail of each component or, location on that Street View and see some details about how you might manage an incident. So that was, it's pretty interesting to me. I thought I'd never seen anything like it before.
Maybe I would double down on some comments on the idea of the map. Mm. And one of the things that I used to do in my previous role was lead some organizations through value stream mapping exercises. And if you've done that before, for an organization who's never done it, it can seem quite painful, and you have to work through their own internal business process to get a team together to understand the larger context of all of the components and the processes that flow into something. And that make revenue through to my daily tasks to kind of draw that line between how does a business make money and who else is involved and to the work that I do and how is that related to them. When I think about this map, while it's contextualized around services and service objectives, it's kind of that same thing where everybody can look at the map, and even though they may only own a point on the map, they understand how that point relates to other core services within an organization. So I'm not saying we're replacing Valley Street mapping. I'm saying we have it's just this digital representation of understanding exactly where you are and how that affects somebody else. So if you're blowing your service level objectives and then upstream you're seeing the same thing happening, well, we know who to talk to and we can sort of organizationally situate ourselves to resolve an incident in a much faster way.
I think
just that shared context is really, really important.
Yeah, that is super interesting to me because I've been reading quite a lot this year, and books like Sooner, Safer, Happier, Team Topologies, they often talk about sort of vertical streamlined teams who can, they own and have autonomy over a service that's provided to customer. Mm-hmm. But in the reality, as you would have known, saying you're working for lots of enterprises, there's lots of sort of component-based teams, and there might be a dozen teams who have to work together to provide a customer service. And having mm-hmm. some way to visually see this is me and where I fit into the stack, and hey, look at all those other teams involved. I think that's so useful to sort of bring mm-hmm. awareness to the bigger picture. I like that a lot.
And I think there's a view of, just organizations are large. The services they provide are large. Even if we start with the platform services team, which is kind of a newish sort of core group. I think it was sort of built out of DevOps culture change and a bunch of other things. We have these deep core platform engineering teams. A lot of the type of back and forth that I used to see between service outages and notifications and things like that was very manual. And you had a downstream customer who owns one app, but that app might actually process credit card payments, right? Like, they're highly dependent on that platform services engine and the services it provides. And yet, if you can't process the credit card payments, then all of a sudden you're really in a bad way from a business perspective. Mm. And yet the platform services team may think that everything's all hunky-dory in their system, and they have a large complex system. So being able to tie the two of those together, the small processing app and its dependency on a platform service that they're publishing up their SLOs and their components, being able to tie those into one view, I think really, really gets the business into a much more efficient state when it comes to resolving that outage and maintaining, functional operation of the business.
I'm curious, with SLOs, if you're in a team and you have a lot of dependencies with other teams or third parties, mm-hmm. for example, does that change the way you think or define SLOs?
To me, there's a standout bit from this is from the state of SRE report that Dynatrace funded, 450 person survey. Stephen, you're quoted in it. I was kind of surprised. Their survey results came back. 99% of the SREs they surveyed said, well, I have a hard time writing a good SLO. Certainly as we look at kind of the conversations that we're having, we kept this sort of good track about 50 interviews, right, as we were starting the company. Across our 50 interviews, maybe 10% of those people said, hey, we're actively using SLOs in our organization. 0% said they were actively tracking month-to-month error budgets. I'd argue the error budget is actually the really, really important thing, and the SLO is just the path to get there. So many people have trouble saying, all right, with an SLO, where do we start? Like, where do I start? Where do I start? And I think for us, this concept of the map came from doing the exercise a bunch where you say, hey, let's start with the really customer-facing. Like, what's the real customer-facing? What's the most important thing here that we can show that if this turns red, everybody on the team should be jumping, and this is the most important fire that could be burning? And then let's run a wheel of misfortune exercise or just a thought exercise to say, hey, if this goes down, if this turns red, where do we look? Where do we look? And we start seeing people, this natural exercise lends itself to building a map from west to east. And the result is actually a wonderful map of somebody's tech stack. It's also really a wonderful map ordered by what matters most. Because you can kind of really quickly say, hey, if there's a fire burning on the left side of the map, everybody should be jumping for that. The fire's on the far right side of the map, those are probably our vendors. There's very little that we can do about that, but we need to know what they're going on. In a macro environment like the one that we are now, where everybody's trying to, these jobs have gotten very hard for everybody. Yeah, we need to, for all of us, I think, to survive this macroeconomic environment, A, we need to do it together, and B, we need to find ways to define scope where we can all be successful. Mm. I think that these types of things really help for a team to be able to say, hey, I know there are 5 burning fires, but we're only staffed to take care of 2 of them. Let's agree that we're going to do a really, really good job on the 2 fires on the far left, because that's what we can do. And we can do a great job at that. And so there's this really nice social contract, I think, when it comes to dealing with other teams. You know, to me, SL is an airbrush arm for the SRE team, of the social contract that our teams have with other teams. You know, how do we sort of say, hey, here's the social contract that I can, in really good faith, I can handle, and here's a social contract that I can't, that just has to be out of scope because we're simply not staffed for it.
A couple of weeks ago, we caught up and had a chat, and one of the things that you brought up was this concept of social reliability engineering, which I had never heard of before, but it sounds very interesting. Could you talk a little bit about what social reliability engineering means and how you came to that?
I think in the macro times that we're going into, these jobs are hard. Right? And if you look at kind of the, let's take the Dynatrace numbers for a second, 97% of SRE managers from that survey said, hey, the hardest challenge they're going to have next year is hiring and retaining an SRE team. So this is very, very difficult. If you actually cut the question and you say, all right, for people who are in the engineering roles, what's the hardest problem? The answer came back actually very different. 85% came back saying, hey, the availability of good automation is going to be the hardest thing that we have to chase over the next 12 months. I thought that was actually particularly interesting. And then if you double click on that, the group of people who answered that question said, hey, why? Because my time is getting so stretched. I don't have time to both write good automation as well as train all of these people that I need to train and deal with all of my external interfaces. There are just too many demands on my time to clear out the strong coding time to write great automation. And so what are we going to do about it? We have the social reliability engineering name. It's specifically, hey, how can SREs get through this very, very well by doing more work with SREs in other organizations? Can we do a really, really good job of code sharing good automation? Can we do a really, really good job of sharing, hey, here are the SLOs that I found were important for this vendor or for this particular open source package? Can we do a really good job of benchmarking to say, hey, we're at a 1.9, we're at 2.9s, why are you at 2.9s, why are we at 1.9, and start a conversation there? So can SREs work across organizational boundaries with each other to make all their systems more reliable, especially where you have vendor dependencies? I think the second part of it is, can SREs work better with other SREs in the organization? Junior-senior relationships. How can senior SREs be wonderful mentors and wonderful coaches from where junior SREs coming onto the team without losing 70 to 80% of their time? Because they need that time to write great automation. And then the third part, for us, is social SRE. If, you know, part one is SREs between organizations. Part two is senior-junior SRE relationships. And part three is, how does the SRE team relate to other teams around them? How do we relate to all of the different functions that surround us? How do we relate to executives in our chain who may only kind of have a vague understanding of what SRE actually means and does and what everybody on the team is doing day to day? How can we create a lot of transparency? How can we create really wonderful agreements on here's what we can do and here's what we can't, and here's what we can do very, very, very well? And how can we be really transparent about, here are the targets that we signed up for, and here's how we do against those targets? So we use the social reliability engineering kind of as a large moniker for all these 3 different categories of relationships that we think are just really important for these teams, as from what Shay and I kind of saw as these teams start and as these teams grow, and the teams that really, really thrive are the ones that do really good jobs at managing these relationships. And we believe that there's room for tools to help every team do as well with these relationships as the top teams do today.
So drilling into one of those relationships, the sort of junior-senior SRE relationship, last time we talked, you mentioned that it takes there's a 2-year ramp-up window, essentially, to be independent and confident on call. Obviously, it makes sense to me, but why do you think that is such a long ramp-up time? Like, what makes it so challenging to uplift a junior SRE to the point that they can run independently?
Maybe I'll take a first stab and then I'll pass over to Shay, because I'm guessing this is one that's pretty interesting to get both our perspectives on that. That number specifically came from 50 interviews that we did with SRE leaders from, I think, folks you'd think of as, hey, wow, those are the top SRE teams in the industry, to folks who are starting an SRE team in the last couple of months. When we ask the question, hey, how long does it take before a new member of the team can be on call by themselves and everybody else can go on vacation? The answer over and over came back, well, you know, we'd like to say it's less, but really it's somewhere between 12 and 24 months, with 24 months showing up over and over and over again. I think this speaks to a lot of the knowledge transfer process for SRE. Before you really can understand a really complicated tech stack, a lot of little bumps in the road need to happen. Oh yeah, that only happens about once a quarter, but the last time that happened, you know, here was the root cause and we did these four things. So effectively, like, learning by incident is a very slow way to learn, but that's the current state of the art. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think that shows up in that number a lot is you're in an era where many vendors, many open source packages are releasing 4 times a year, 8 times a year, 12 times a year. And the sheer number of times when, oh, hey, yes, I was an expert in that, you know, in my last role, but that was V3. They're now on to V5 and actually kind of get root causing an issue with V5 is materially different now because they just broke up a lot of the internal architecture. Gosh, we've seen that in our own tech stack twice now in a fairly short period of time. This very, very rapid aging out of troubleshooting knowledge specific to an open source project or specific to a vendor. I think this also leads to this, hey, oh, I need to retrain myself. Oh, X just posted a new version. I now need to retrain myself on that. I think that leads to a lot of the, why does it take so long for somebody to get up to a level of mastery in a complex tech stack?
Shane, what are your thoughts on the junior, senior uplift?
There's nothing I disagree with that Kyle said. That's all not from interviews, from my experience. That is from experience. Those are from working with managed services teams, building out big platforms at the government scale, and still knowing the guy by name who you call in the middle of the night when stuff goes down. And I'm talking, this is like 5-6 years in the cycle. And what I witnessed through that was, frankly, it takes 6 months to get budget approval to get the junior to come on board. Like there's a whole budget approval to and justification of headcount. We laugh, but it's hard and it takes time, and hiring, especially in a government situation or something like that, is typically difficult because, frankly, most government, at least in the Canadian world, which is most of my experience, it is difficult to hire top tier that a corporation or a private sector organization isn't going to yank out for double the salary. And there are other benefits to working in government, but that's a hard sector. And that's where we need a lot of the skill and talent. And so a couple of things happen. You augment that workforce. You either do it by hiring who you can, which takes 6 months to get them on board. And then you have a training program. But guess what? Your senior SRE is too busy putting out fires or adjusting to the new releases that Kyle's talking about, right? That's for real. Like, Kubernetes as a platform is complex enough, let alone now all the deployment patterns for all of the applications on top of it have now become more complex. So there's maintaining currency with the skills gap there, let alone finding time to train somebody or to teach them what you knew. So then you augment that team. If you get that guy through, and usually after 2 years, quite often still not confident enough to run on their own because they're spread too thin, supporting too many clients, and they're generalists across the whole platform. And generalists, kind of not the position you want at the SRE level. They're kind of, you know, somewhere before that. Then you augment, and you augment with high cost consultancy firms. And I happen to know this because I built one of those. And the advice all of the time was, much of the time was, you don't want me doing this for you. I want to teach you how to do it. I want to build you a stack that can do this for you and train your team. But I don't want to do this myself, because if I leave, or the knowledge goes, like, there's a high risk on you. And in many of those situations, that was a risk the organization was willing to take because they had no other option. And so just maintaining the staff once you can get approval for them, or trying to maintain the knowledge from outside consultancy, seems to be the challenge here, because not a lot of that is codified. And so it doesn't retain with the organization. And then you kind of start back at ground zero every 2 years. And what I've seen in the tech hiring world recently, it gets really hard. There's jobs everywhere, and it's really a worker's choice at this point. It's a worker's market. Yeah. So that really puts the organizations at a disadvantage.
So obviously, ideally, organizations would figure out ways to retain their great staff, mm-hmm. but obviously that's not necessarily the case. So in a situation where you're expecting engineers to move in and out every 2 or 3 years, how do you persist mm-hmm. that knowledge in the organization so that you don't lose so much when they go?
One of the things I've seen very interestingly is the ability to rotate through an organization. So instead of losing that knowledge to an external force, that knowledge is retained within the organization, within that person, but they move to a different team, which keeps it fresh, right? That's the other challenge with this is engineers like to change what they work on all the time and to keep it interesting. And sometimes, you know, that doesn't always work in their favor. And so they get bored and they look outside of the organization. So there's a practice of that where you move people are onto different teams, so they both cross-train and still retain institutional knowledge. But the better thing is, how do we get the institutional knowledge out of their head and into something else? And I think that there's an element there where that's codifying it. And in our view of the world, we that's codifying that in automation. But at the same state, I think where we are headed and where we want to go is open sourcing that automation so that that can actually be shared externally as well. You can have, like, many engineers like to participate in the open source world, and they like to contribute to other projects that they're passionate about. So if they moved out into another, like a Kafka project or something like that, and spent a bunch of time there, wouldn't you still want to be able to consume their knowledge by using some of the open source sort of automation that they build out in the public, and not necessarily holding that in the four walls of the organization?
Okay. I'm sort of piecing together how this might work. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, partly, yes, you've got staff in your own organization, and if you're codifying and sort of open sourcing the automation that they've built to solve certain problems, that's also one thing. But you might have a situation, you were saying that, I don't know, let's say Kubernetes, there's new versions of it coming out, and you might be really good and have known something, but you go away for a year and come back and it's moved on. And suddenly the things that you thought you knew, you don't anymore. But luckily, some other person on the other side of the world has codified and kept their scripts up to date, which helps you, you know, resolve and look into incidents. So is that the kind of the world we're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there's another angle to this that we could consider as well. And this goes a little bit back to your junior to senior SRE training and onboarding conversation as well. And I know Kyle has some interesting insights from his experience here as well, which is not every junior SRE or not every SRE that needs to, that can be left on their own, needs to understand every component of the platform in its entirety. And you don't have to be a Kube expert to necessarily support the application running on Kube if you have the right tools. And I think that's the other sort of component that we're looking at, is a lot of people are trying to hire engineers saying, do you have 20 years Kubernetes experience? And I laugh because that's obviously not possible. But that might not be necessary if your senior SREs can write good tools. And I think, Kyle, you had always said it to me in the way that, like, how do I make a junior SRE effective from day one? By giving them a tool set, not by saying, go take this training course and I'll see you in half a year. And then you tell me what you learned, right? And I think that there's another aspect to that, which is making the junior level SREs also feel confident so that they can explore more with the right tools in a safe way. And that's another way of sort of improving that relationship and retaining the talent, because they don't get stuck and bored and, you know, sleeping through training classes. Because I don't know if you've taken a 2-week training class, but it can be difficult at times.
Yep. Yeah. Interesting. You're talking about making sure that junior SREs feel confident. Yeah, I've totally seen that in the work that I was doing in the previous organization. We had a junior who we wanted to embed in a team. So she went in and did on-call for that team with very little support. And it was very stressful for her. And I know in SRE, we talk a lot about psychological safety. And so I think it's very important that we, you know, don't throw them in the deep end anymore. Like that's the attitude, I think. You know, at the start of my career, that was like almost encouraged. Throwing people in the deep end was a good thing, but I don't think it leads to great outcomes. Ultimately, it's going to scar them for life.
I've certainly talked before at length about burnout and engineering overload, and that's another angle to the question: how do we retain our talent, or how do we keep that? Yeah, you know, how do we keep the engineers happy? Which is retaining our talent. It's avoiding burnout, and it's not saying, here's cluster admin. We're doing a rollout on Friday. And we'll see you on Monday. Good luck. And you know, you're on by, like, that is one of those things which is not today an accepted practice. And so giving them the right tools and the right safety in those tools to go and explore, I think, is really, really powerful and gives them the confidence without going, oh no, what if I hit the wrong thing? Is my job over? Like, people work in fear when they're working on production systems of losing their job. And I think that's a culture we need to get away from, right? And that's partially solved with tools.
Not to be too selfish about the metaphor, but I mean, picture you dropped into a foreign city and somebody said, okay, so drive from the middle of the city out to the freeway. A, there's, you have no map and you're just going to do it by trial and error. And that very much is I think for many people, that is the state of the art in onboarding a new SRE into the stack today. Mm-hmm. Step two is, hey, well, we had a couple of people kind of do brain dumps in a wiki as best we could. And I kind of think that's like the paper map era. You're like, okay, so I know that I need to get to the freeway. Here's a paper map. A lot of the streets have changed and, you know, there might be construction along the routes. So like, I'm going to have to get kind of creative, but at least it's a pretty good start. And then there's step three, which is like Google Maps driving directions, which is like going to route you around traffic. And, you know, a lot of different people can collaborate on the map. So if a street name changes, then somebody somewhere can probably update the thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that just the probability that you get somebody to success goes way, way, way up.
I love that. Google Maps driving directions for on-call support.
That's the tagline.
A lot of this reminds me of the Phoenix Project and the character Brent, who was the one guy who had to, he knew everything, and it was a dual problem because I think he quite liked the fact that he knew everything, but then getting that knowledge out and sort of dissipating it around. But another thing I've been reading a lot about recently is cognitive load within individuals and teams. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot in SRE. It's so broad. You can be expected to know so many things at both a deep and a wide level. It's just overwhelming. And just being realistic about, hey, for this team or this individual, there's only so much that they can actually hold in their head at one time, and keeping it limited. And yeah, we can use tools to help us be able to keep on top of more, because like you said, suddenly you don't have to be an absolute expert at Kubernetes, because you can use scripts and guidance, your Google Maps guidance to help you through that.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, there's an interesting way to codify some of the decisions that you make in your head. And that could be, use your example of Kubernetes, right? There, you and I could probably rhyme off 10 things that you should check for first if something's going bad in Kube, right? It's probably the same 10 things that most people in every organization want to use. Do you know those commands off by heart? Yeah, might be a little Stack Overflow, might be a couple of tabs in bash completion. No, there might be a little bit of that going on. But why wouldn't we just write it once and output it and set the and go like good or bad? Like let's help people get through without trying to teach them every component of the system all the way through. Because frankly, they're in a fire. And to your point of cognitive load, you know, how can you develop any meaningful deep SRE work when you're currently putting out tiny fires all day long because you're the only one with the knowledge in your head putting out the tiny fires? That is, it's thrashing, it's stressful, you still feel burnt out, and you feel like you've accomplished nothing because you made no headway on the actual projects you're probably incented to complete.
There's also, talk about cognitive load for the team and workloads overall and burnout. One thing that we're just starting to see, and I think it was an interesting one across conversations with our beta users, amongst SRE managers, there's a really interesting divide. Like in our industry, we've talked about SLOs a lot, and I think that we have some strongly held beliefs on that front. But there's some, I'd say, really like the gift, like you can kind of tell, like the really gifted SRE managers that we work with that are using SLOs now, or at least using us to like introduce SLOs as a way of bounding what their team needs to have cognitive load about. Our team, you know, there are these 10 SLOs, and this is what we're responsible for, and we're responsible for systems that touch those, and systems that don't touch those, we can't take responsibility for. That's a wonderful conversation, actually, with one of our first investors and a big inspiration for the product. He was one of the first directors of SRE at Google, and he had a story of exactly this. I was saying, hey, I would use this. He's like, well, I would show everybody the map, and I'd say, hey, my team can handle every service that's on the map, and if it's not on the map, we can have an interesting conversation about getting it on the map. But I can't, you know, with my team, have somebody who's a deep expert in the tech stack that your particular team just wrote enough that we can staff on call to it, because that's the 500th app and we're 10 of us. It was a very interesting conversation of how to use SLOs to say, hey, our team can be deep experts in this area. Our team can staff on call to this area. And if it's not on the map, our team can't. And it's a different conversation, not can we or can't we. It's a conversation to say, hey, how can we be funded to do that? It's a part of the SLO conversation that I haven't seen in the industry as much, because most really we talk about SLOs for our own consumption rather than SLOs to help define scope.
I was going to say, I think that's another interesting element to social reliability engineering. In that term is more also opening up the social communication lines between the product owners and the lines of business and the technical engineers, and talking about what matters. And aligning towards the same goal is going to be much better and reduce friction for everybody else. But if we don't know why that matters, what that SLO represents, we're less incented to maintain it. So it opens up the conversation for an engineer to go, you know what, maybe I'm not going to go work on a bunch of this other stuff that frankly doesn't help me get there. And it's that sort of priority conversation and how we reprioritize our tasks.
Okay. So yeah, SLOs can help you bring that alignment between what technology and the business are doing and keeping it aligned with customer outcomes. Yeah, I think that's really the core purpose in my mind about what they're all about. But do you think that there are some challenges in when you start talking about SLOs to getting those different stakeholders with different backgrounds together to talk about these things and make sense of them together? Have you seen challenges in that space?
I've certainly seen plenty of challenges on the other side when people don't, and you wind up with these teams with terrible burnout that are taking tickets. Oh, my so-and-so app, you know, was down for 20 minutes yesterday. Your so-and-so app is a 3 degrees removed internal application that's used by a grand total of 4 people across our 6,000 person enterprise. Mm-hmm. We can't be on call for that. It's, you know, the failure mode plenty of times when the SRE team takes responsibility for reliability of for five nines uptime of every single system in the entire enterprise, because that's not humanly possible.
I always had this idea that SLOs, they needed to ultimately go back to some like business objective. You know what I mean? Like they couldn't just be a technical thing, but I don't know whether that just might be my sort of naive interpretation of that. Do you think that that's always the case, that, hey, we've set this particular objective for our servers, and the reason we've set it is because we want this for our business or for our customers? Is that, should it always be like that, or is it, can it be just something else? I don't know.
There's a lot of internal SLOs that may never see the customer, the paying customer, the revenue paying customer, that are still material to their experience. But I think there's also a lot of customers that are internal that are material to that experience as well. And I think, and Kyle's point about, an SLO can also be a set of boundaries. And so, you know, trying to achieve the highest SLO shouldn't actually be the goal. In my mind, there's a balance between an SLO and an error budget. And if we want our teams to be innovative, we have to balance the two of those quite well, because an SLO gives you an error budget. But if our SLO is up and we're hitting 100% and we spent none of our error budget, as an innovation person, I would question what the team is doing. And so I think this kind of leans into the type of organizational change that happens along implementing SRE practices. We saw a lot of this with DevOps trying to break down some of these walls. And I think it comes back to a shared goal, which does always involve friction between teams. But usually the conversation ends up in clarity. You may not agree with it, but ultimately, you know, that number, that SLO should work both ways. It should work to support the business, which includes also supporting the staff and giving them enough space to start to, I think of things like, hey, we're going to transitioning to a new service. Let's start by dropping our SLO on some of our services as an incentive to get other teams to move off of this internally. I've worked with enough platform migrations within an organization that never see the paying customer the light of day. Like, they never see that, but they're very costly. To cost in terms of financial reasons, and also like emotional toil on the engineers and their resources. And if you're still running a platform you plan to decommission 2 years ago, that's a problem. Well, an SLO could be a pretty nifty tool to motivate people to get off, because, well, if they're promising 99.95 and you've just all of a sudden published a 60, oh, okay, but we have this 99.95 over here. It's a new service. Would you like to move to it? Absolutely, I'm on it. And I think even that changes internally how the organization would operate. And yes, there's going to be friction, but there's always going to be friction between teams. It's about having a conversation and maybe using that data point as a way to unstick the friction.
I really like that. I've never heard of that before. See your SLO and say, we're going to provide you 50% availability. And you're like, well, maybe we'll go somewhere else. I like that a lot.
It's interesting the way humans behave once they're given a constraint or a boundary, right? And SLO could serve that as well. It doesn't necessarily serve the end user.
Let me just say, teams that have been using SLOs for the longest in the industry, you wind up seeing actually a lot of not five nines, an incredible amount of intellectual honesty that says, hey, we built this system for 1.9. If you don't like that, you're going to have to engineer around it. But that's what we built it for, because getting this up to 2.9s is, you know, two orders of magnitude more engineering investment that we'll do over the next couple of years, but we're not going to have that done next weekend. And I think that's really the folks where you see, I think, who have just been doing this the longest, you wind up seeing a lot of non-5-9s, and you see a lot of intellectual honesty. And I think a lot of it comes because, frankly, I think most organizations, when they think SLO, they kind of stop at the objective. The important thing here to me is getting to the error budget. Mm-hmm. I think that's something Shay and I talk about a lot. Like, the industry almost stopped at SLOs instead of saying, no, the really important thing is that we say, how much error budget do you have left this month? And then how much error budget do you have left next month? And if you blow your error budget every month for 3 months, then let's lower the objective, or let's invest in some rewrites, or let's invest in automated remediation, all of which are expensive. But if we blow our error budget 3 months in a row, that is a decision that we need to make. And I think a lot of people stop at writing the SLO on paper when actually that's, I think that's actually only like one step of, like, actually that's like only one step down a 10-step journey here.
If I was to paraphrase, are you saying we spend heaps of time defining these objectives, but not actually setting or executing consequences when we don't meet them? Mm-hmm. I've definitely seen that a lot. It's like, so what? We're tracking this thing and it's red sometimes, but we don't do anything. So what was the point in defining it in the first place?
It's another metric, right? And, or it's a roll-up of the metrics, but so what? We now have another metric, which still, until it alerts, we don't do anything. That ties a little bit on some of the change that needs to happen as well within the teams. And we talked a little bit about friction before. And this can be one of the causes of friction, is when culturally you're organizing around an SLO, but financially you're incenting people not based off of that. And all of a sudden you've got a friction of an engineer's time going, well, I want to make my bonus. And if my bonus isn't aligned with SLO or air budget, you know, numbers, I'm a little bit less incented to focus my efforts in that way. And I think that, you know, there continues to be those types of changes that need to happen in an organization. We can't just set the number and hope people will rally around it if they're not financially motivated to do so. And that's not to say people are always financially motivated, but that's to say that, you know, we work to support our lives, and, you know, we're gonna do our best to make sure that our families are well taken care of. And unfortunately, that might be at odds with some of the initiatives of setting SLOs.
Do you think that there are different stakeholders who are interested in the concept of SLOs versus error budgets? Is that one of the reasons why error budgets don't get we don't quite get there?
You know, from left to right, you could definitely see different interest along the way. And I think that's always been the case, where engineering teams aren't directly related or financially to performance of the product or the solution or what have you. And that's because organizations are highly complex, and so are technology teams. But the goal is to get them better aligned. But I think there even could be fighting at that SLO target setting point. And that's where some of the friction can exist in an organization. But that's also where it can outline some of the gaps. And I think Kyle's, I know he's mentioned, he's seen this before, where, hey, by the way, we've looked at one of our maps and we've set an SLA with our customers that is 99.59s, but nowhere on the map do we see an SLO anywhere else that matches that, and nor do we have SLAs anywhere across the map that matches that. All of a sudden, you might be having a very different conversation with your customer, and that customer might be, to his previous example of, we're going to drop this because there's actually no way we can achieve it, and we're stuck with the penalty otherwise. That's a bad business decision, right? And frankly, the engineer, while not seeing that, we'll get yelled at from the product owner no matter what if they're not hitting that, because the company's liable for the penalty. Mm. And I think that that's, you know, hard conversations, but useful conversations.
I just had one more question I was interested in. So as I think you're the first people on the show who have any experience with Google or have worked for Google before, and I was curious what you thought about SRE permeating around the industry and other organizations attempting to implement what they call SRE, but how what they're implementing might be completely different to what Google's doing. How do you feel about that at all? Do you think it's successful, or is it a good thing?
I think there are a few, I'm going to be a bit careful about what I say here, but I think there are a few big, at least, lessons that I learned. The first, I would say, at Google, there's an incredibly strong culture of, across many, many parts of the organization, carefully defining, you know, working with your stakeholders around you very, very carefully, you as an individual, you as a team, you as a large organization of many teams, carefully defining the objectives under which you can be successful, taking incredible ownership of making those objectives successful, and then not taking on objectives other than those. And it's this kind of incredible transparency that teams are able to do. And I think that the SRE approach thrives, like really, really, really thrives within that. Whereas the traditional operations approach is, hey, we're responsible for all the things. And I think that it's really hard to take that traditional, I think without this, like, hey, here's what we do and we're going to be really, really, really good at it. But it is a bounded box. Without that, I think it's hard to make SRE thrive. Mm. So I think point one is kind of the tight definition of scope. Point two, if you actually look, I mean, I'll put some numbers to it. If you look about circa, give or take about 2.5 years ago, there were around 7,000 people on LinkedIn using SRE as their job title, which meant that about half, I think, of the SREs in the world or people on LinkedIn using SRE in their job title, about half of them worked at Google and Facebook. Mm. Now, because of the ability within those organizations to do incredible amounts of code sharing, you'd get the, oh, hey, we have the perfect set of scripts to triage GitLab 3.8 and now GitLab 4.0, they're actually not super relevant. When you can spread the load across that many different people, that while they're working on different parts of their tech stack, there's a lot of repeating patterns, then you wind up with a huge amount of time savings on automation and you wind up with great automation because instead of, okay, one person writes this, period, and that's the only contributor, you wind up with these automation code bases where one person wrote the first version and then it was added to by two other people and added to by three other people and then forked twice and then remerged. And you get these wonderful automation scripts that now have had 30 or 40 contributors to them. Well, if half the SREs in the world work for Google and Facebook, that means half of the SREs in the world are participating in these ecosystems of people doing a lot of sharing. Mm-hmm. And I think unless we take a very kind of open source community approach and get people within our profession to all start working with each other across organizational boundaries, A, we're going to have a hard time because every SRE script is going to have exactly one contributor, and that's a really, really bad place to be. But the upside of it is that if we can get a lot of people working together, then we can actually recreate these ecosystems. We'll recreate them as a profession rather than as a company. I think that's good. The number of people now out in SRE snapshot 3 months ago, when I did the search again, the number of people outside of Google and Facebook in SRE is now double the number of people inside those companies. If this continues anywhere near at pace with a reasonably successful open source community, we can actually have more people working on these scripts outside the big teams than there are inside. And that's a very interesting, very, very, very interesting place to be. That was not possible 4 or 5 years ago. That was not possible 3 years ago. I think that is becoming increasingly possible now.
And then that brings it full circle, right? So the social reliability engineering part comes into play. Not everyone can work for a giant company like Google and Facebook with their power and resources. But hey, you know, 1,000 smaller companies all, you know, working together in an open source way can achieve a similar kind of ecosystem. I think that's pretty powerful. Is that, am I explaining that right? Is that kind of what you're thinking as well?
It's like, take a look at a lot of other organizations now in the software they're running. They're not writing their own pub/sub systems. They're not writing their, like they're using infrastructure that's largely based on open source. And I think our view of the world is naturally to extend that to the operational side of this. And, you know, there's bits and pieces out there that exist already today along those realms, Ansible Tower with its playbooks and things like that, that are largely used for like sort of operational remediation and triage. I think our view is to collect that all together in a sort of a easier to consume system, but still support that open source SRE based automation platform. That's really what it comes down to with the shared view. Like that's really what it's, I don't know, to me, the one thing that's really interesting is the map, the view, being able to actually have your local team look at what's going on using global resources to help triage and debug and troubleshoot and fix and remediate your stuff. I think that's kind of, I don't know, the panacea, if you ask me.
Well, I mean, I'm sold on the idea of social reliability engineering. I think it's awesome. And we're almost at time. And I just wanted to thank both of you for this, I think, amazing conversation. Is there anything you'd like to say before we close off today? Shout outs.
Well, I mean, I hope you didn't hear too much of the snoring of my dog in the corner. He is one of the dogs of SRE. But if you didn't, then I'm glad, but he's been quite loud in my ear.
No, I couldn't hear. Unfortunately, that would have been entertaining.
I also just want to say how much we appreciate not only having us on the podcast, but the existence of your podcast. I mean, this is the work that you're doing right now, I think, to pull the community together. I mean, at least on behalf of a small group of us, we really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I'm very excited that this is now part of my daily work. This is my job. And I know I've done a lot of solo content, but I'd like to get, you know, a lot more interviews. And I really appreciate that.
I was going to say thank you so much and good luck on the new role. That's also super exciting. I'm glad this is part of your role too. And I'm sure it gives you a little more time in the evenings if this is part of your day job now. Yeah.
All right, thanks once again, Kyle and Shay, for that awesome discussion on social reliability engineering. And that's all from another episode of Slight Reliability. And I'll see you next week.